This is an interview with Mr. Dean Phillips for the Youngstown State University History of Salem Schools Project by James L. McNeil at the Salem Senior High on East 6th Street, Salem, Ohio, on October the 29th, 1975 at 3:15 p.m. Mr. Phillips, first thing I'd like to ask you is how and why you got involved in education.
Well, it's an odd circumstance in a way. In 1932, I graduated from Worcester with liberal arts, AB degree, right in the middle of a depression. Changed my degree, maybe from pre-teaching and also from pre-civil engineering to liberal arts with a math and English major. After about 12 years managing a chain grocery store, and after coming out of the service in 1946, I decided to go into teaching. Got my BS of education from Mountain Union, 1950. And did some graduate work at Kent State University. As a teacher, started teaching in 1946, and in 1951, the supervisor of child accounting here in Salem died, and one of the faculty members applied for the job, which involved enumeration throughout the summer, after which he decided to resign. It was pretty tedious work. The school enumeration at that time was quite tedious. It meant marking up every child by age, school, location, grade, and so forth. So he decided he really didn't care for it. And this superintendent at the time asked me to come over and take over the job. I was a local boy, and he felt probably I knew the physical and social characteristics of a school district in such a way I could probably tie in with what he had in mind. So
this was 1951.
That's in 1951 in the fall, yes, about after school had started. He'd asked me, but maybe it'd be interesting to have a makeup of the Salem School District. Maybe you wish to ask some questions after that.
Okay, fine.
The school district actually is pretty compact. It's made up of 18 square miles only, has 4,000 enrollment. Has a senior high school, a four-year senior high school, 1,325 students. Two-year junior high of 675. Five elementary public schools. And one parochial school, about 140 pupils. My job is kind of a unique thing. It's child accounting isn't kind of a basic job, but the job description is tied in with transportation. It's sometimes called supervisor of pupil personnel. But maybe if I give you a few of the in the job description, a few of the areas of responsibility, maybe lead to some question.
Okay.
First thing, basic thing, is to keep a continuous enumeration by the families and by location of all these pupils in the whole school district. That can be used for tuition purposes, transportation programs, distribution of pupils, and so forth. But in addition, a lot of other detailed work has to be done. As an attendance officer, too, I handle the mechanics of attendance at the senior high and any referrals by the principals for any homeschool liaison. work. I maintain this file of permanent records for all pupils who have been through kindergarten through eighth grade, that is. If they withdraw, the records come to my office, being a central child accounting office, then any one school to which they transfer can apply there for transcript of their work. Then we issue work certificates between the ages of 14 and 17 inclusive. A person getting a promise of a job must make application through my office for a work certificate by state law. They have three preliminary cards and they fill them out, one to the applicant parents, one to the employer, and one to the doctor, at which time we issue the work certificate. As I stated before, this liaison between the school and the community has a lot of aspects to it. It's a liaison between the juvenile court, the local police, churches, homes, and so forth. And we have a supply of information of all the families for state reports, whether they be transportation, psychological, and so forth. One example might be to screen, review, and pass on applications for the free lunch program, which is centralized in this office, because we have to be alert to all time to cases of welfare, child abuse, underprivileged, denied, deprived families, and so forth. There's this transportation probably is the biggest problem and takes about 20 to 25% of the time, because my capacity there is one of scheduling, routing, and handling problems as they arise in the transportation of approximately 1,400 kids to the school. And I believe that's about an overview of the various areas of involvement I get into. You know what? Basically, we have to keep abreast of all these social forces that causes these physical changes in the school system, in the matter of projections and things like that. But since I have a list of control cards of all families of every student in the district, well, I were able to do that. It's a little odd. I mean, I hate to take too much time now, but maybe just to change to as a point of reference here. When you have housing developments on the outside of town, for instance, increases the need for busing. You have the state demanding two-way kindergarten busing. Special classes have to be centrally located, and they've increased from 2 in the last 13 or 14 years to 7, LD, BD, and EMR, and so forth. That presents a problem in one respect, because they are eligible to be transported to these special classes if they live a mile away from town, and since they live scattered throughout the district, we have to make arrangements and know where they are and know who they are. St. Paul students are eligible to be transported. They live throughout our whole school district, and if they live a mile or more from their school, which is kindergarten through sixth grade now, they're able to be transported. And we have to tie it in with our regular runs. Some aspects of social changes and effects, actually, this may have some bearing. 1951, when I started, there were 2,900 pupils. And then that peaked to 4,500 in 1968, which came as an aftermath of the late 40s baby boom. And now it's drifted back to 4,000. The entrance policy in 1957 was changed so that it was necessary to be 5 by September 30th in order to be eligible for kindergarten. That made a difference in 1 year, because it represented 3/4 of a year's pupils, you might say that, kindergarten year, that is. 1967, I remember not only did the 4th Street School, a centrally located school, was condemned, but a new GM plant came in, which affected our school population. Another thing might be when 1966, when St. Paul's discontinued their cafeteria, had a decided effect on the number attending St. Paul's, which was an influx in our schools and the outlying schools, which sometimes overcrowded the younger, the primary grades and so forth. But in 1972, St. Paul's eliminated 7th and 8th grade right after they had eliminated a cafeteria a few years before, which had another effect. All these things have to be anticipated and see what impact they have on our transportation program and so forth. Now, I just went across that very rapidly. Maybe that might provoke some
questions. Some things I hadn't thought of beforehand. Going back to 1951, this is when you took over. You say that the previous supervisor, or you make mention of the previous supervisor. Who was that? Do you recall?
Well, the one that died in 51, the spring of 51, that was, they called him Smiley Rich.
Smiley Rich.
Was his familiar name. His name was Clyde.
Do you have a fancy title, or was he a truant officer at that time?
No, he was supervisor of child accounting, which was changed in the late 30s when the accent or it was on the positive rather than negative. In other words, truant officer really feels negative. Attendance officer is positive. And that's about when it was changed, I think, around 39 or 40, along in there.
There's a psychology to the title then, rather than...
Yes, I think so.
When you took over in 1951, do you have any recollections of how you felt when you stepped into that job right out of your earlier experience into a child accounting situation?
My misgivings to a certain degree because of the type of job it was. Had two young children coming up through school, which a lot of times they have to act out their defense when the father's in an authoritative position like that. But we got through all right. But I was familiar. It was very interesting. It was challenging, and I had to really build up from nothing because the suddenness of the departure of this gentleman just left it. Whole thing in a hodgepodge, and we had at that time we had 4 buses under contract. I remember that's built up to our present 10. Transport 1,400 pupils. We have vocational set up with Alliance. We have to transport some 36 pupils over there. But it's been very interesting over the years, and sometimes frustrating, and sometimes gratifying.
Well, that'd be a total of, just for rough figures, say 25 years.
Yes, in this job.
And you mentioned, as child accounting. But in the overview you gave there, you mentioned a lot of things as they are now, some reference to things as they have had influence in the past years. What do you see as the biggest changes in the area in, say, the last 25 years with regard to your job?
In regards to job, that, excuse me, that brings up a point. The way you handle a job, depending on the demands. I recall in the field of welfare and needs, in other words, when you find the physical and emotional needs of the kids, back in maybe 15, 17 years ago, we had an appeal for used clothing, protective clothing, by all the elementary principals, well, in junior high too. And they would bring in boots, shoes, heavy coats, basically those 3 things. And I would store them, and as I run across the need for some of them, I'd be able to furnish it to them, to the needy families. as the years progressed, not only was there more money and less need for things like that, there were more places where these people could get them, the deprived and underprivileged people. But then the time ran so short, as we got more pupils and more problems and so forth, what I sometimes call the present permissive society, we haven't the time, nor we still buy some. I make application to service clubs as I run across a case. I make application to service club. See, we belong to the Salem School Health Advisory Council, mm-hmm. and that's one of our jobs, is one of the job descriptions I failed to mention, was that the supervisor of child accounting is the chairman of the funding committee of the Health Advisory Council. The service clubs do a marvelous job in funding all these needs that we bring to their attention, and I spend about $200 a year of their money in isolated cases. Okay. Now, excuse me, now that's progressed to the point where I think the big problem right now is the rebellion of youth against any kind of authority, which makes it doubly difficult in dealing with families, because when I could get into the home, deal with the family, then they would put the clamps on the boy or girl, and usually they were benefited. But lately, too many times, the boys and girls are dictating to the parents, and it makes it doubly hard. Because I've run across many cases where they're just outright lying on the part of the families in complete frustration. They don't know what to do. But then basically we've got wonderful things now. In other words, we've got what we sorely needed, which is a juvenile attention center, which allows our juvenile court to place somebody in a holding form so that he can have a chance to compare the privileges he had under his parents and the school system in which he did not behave, with a school system where there are no privileges except what's earned by their getting merits, you know, for their chores and so forth.
Now, with all those things to do, you surely don't work by yourself. What kind of auxiliary help do you have?
Well, I work actually dovetail with the nurse. The nurse and I work together in many home visitations. I assist a psychologist in making contacts and preparing the families of all these people for various referrals, whether they're coming from psychologists, principals, nurse, or whoever it is. Mm-hmm. Sometimes we're in a position to go in and talk to the families. The unfortunate part is that there's not too many help. We have a secretary who is not only secretary to child accounting, but to the nurse, and to the psychologist, and to the superintendent at times, when the need arises. But we do the best we can, but unfortunately, at times, the frustration comes when it is watered down too much, and you don't have the time, because when you're out working on a transportation problem, you may have a demand for a behavioral problem from some principal trying to get a hold of you, and you're not there. But all in all, I think we're very fortunate, because we handling the mechanics of attendance here at the high school, I keep my fingers on it, kind of centralize it. And I have a running account of all absences by reason on everyone's schedule card, which allows me to, for counseling purposes, to talk to them and their parents when I see a pattern arising that might mean trouble in the near future. So that helps quite a bit. I do have one help as a vocational work study girl who helps in the summer. See, the summertime is spent drawing up with all the mobility of the present day population. You can have so many people located in the spring. But the trouble is finding, making sure where all these people are before school starts, so that you can set up your routes to equalize the loads, equalize the distances and the time involved, and also get to all the schools with all the hazards, you know, and the holdups of city traffic and so forth, and other demands such as keeping buses off of certain streets that are posted under 8,000 pound and so forth. But all in all, I think we're pretty favorable ground. I mean, we have a pretty favorable situation here in Salem.
Would you say the job has definitely gotten more difficult in the last 20, 25 years?
It's extremely more difficult because there's so many details affecting so many more boys and girls that at times it's frustrating and you don't think that you're really getting your job done. And we just don't have time for little things that we feel are of service to the boys and girls as we see the needs. Today I went out and I bought 2 pairs of shoes for people that the referral came from the principal and also an interested mother who was an aide in one of the schools. I took time. Sometimes I didn't have the time. I couldn't do it maybe for 3 or 4 days before I'd get around to doing it. But it was just an illustration of, at one time I was able to go out and probably make 5 or 6 home contacts in one day, supplying some need that they have or having a conference with the parents and so forth.
I'd like to come back to the business of child accounting and some of the problems and some of the areas that you get involved in more detail and more questions. But before we do that, I'd like to back up just a little bit. You mentioned that you were a hometown boy. Do I take that to mean that you were born and raised in Salem?
That's right.
And you would have gone through the Salem schools,
yes.
Yourself. What schools were involved in your years in public education as a student?
Well, excuse me, when I started the old Columbia Street School, which was centrally located at that time, the town wasn't as big and spread out as it is now, that was demolished in 1927, I think, replaced by the Riley School, which is also centrally located. Then when I got to 5th grade, it didn't have any more room over in Columbia Street, so we had to go from a block and a half in Columbia Street, walk out to McKinley School, that is still here, for 5th and 6th grade. Then I went to junior high in the old 4th Street building that was condemned in 67 and raised a year or so ago. I was junior high, then the present junior high at that time was a high school, then we came out to high school. And those are the 4 schools involved when I went. We didn't have kindergarten in those days. Kindergarten was established here in 1948 out in the Buckeye School, which is a new school, out in the northwest part of town. 1948, they had 19 pupils. At the present time, we have, well, approximately 300. More interesting, I believe, is the fact that in kindergarten today, we have 99 2/3% attendance of all those people located. In other words, the people we know are here. Probably last year, there were only 3 people who didn't attend kindergarten, didn't sign up for kindergarten in the fall.
This would be 5-year-olds, roughly
5-year-olds.
You mentioned the Columbia Street School. I still want to stay on a more personal level for right now. You would have been there for 4 years and 4 grades.
Yes.
Do you have any recollections at all? You'd have been quite young, but that building, most people don't even remember being there. They think of the A&P and that's it. But I wonder if you have any recollections of that building, even though you would have been quite young.
I have recollections of the building. I can recollect being thrown off the fire escapes by the teacher. I recollect having a portable at the time, not thrown off physically, but ordered off. I can't recollect too many things. I had a little brother who was had tuberculosis of the bone that I had to transport back and forth by wagon and sled. He died in his first grade. But I can't recall too many things except the big wooded area and a big gully, which is now the A&P, That was all gullied then because it left the school building there and just went right straight down into a big hollow. And I can't recall too many things there. I can't recall who the principal was, to tell you the truth.
Well, did you have, perhaps you can remember, did you have a schedule similar to the grade school with recesses and open lunches and so forth at that time?
Oh yes, open lunches, definitely. I mean, never thought of cafeteria, but they had recesses, morning and afternoon.
Pretty much the same?
About the same as today in the elementary schools. I can't recall anything. To tell you the truth, you can't think back that far.
Well, what I'm getting at is having gone through the Salem school system and then by way of Worcester and the service and other background, the college level, you know, out of public school, you were familiar then with staff and administration, perhaps some individuals prior to taking that first job in student accounting. You knew E.S. Kerr, for example.
Yes, he hired me.
I'm curious, how did he go about hiring? I've interviewed some other people and there's some interesting stories about Mr. Kerr would, for example, drive a good distance to see somebody, Miss Thorpe, for example, up in Ravenna, and actually went after her after she had been recommended to him. Were there any stories associated with your knowledge of him and how you picked up the job?
Not that I know of, really, because when the man who applied, Mr. Jacobs, applied for this job at Smiley Rich's death, he really didn't know what the job involved. And when he suddenly resigned at the end of the summer before school started, that meant they had no supervisor then until Mr. Kerr explored someone who could go. And as I said before, I believe the fact that I was local and he knew me, I'd been in the service, come back, and he knew the family, I believe he felt that possibly I would be better off because I'd taught 4 years then in junior high teaching math. Mm-hmm. And I had a fairly good rapport with the kids and staff. We got along well, and I imagine he felt I would be most likely to adjust to the situation. But, I really can't say that we did take one little jaunt to Columbus, I remember, together. And he talked it over, and that's when I made my decision. That's all I recall.
So he more or less came after you.
He probably just came over and asked me to take the job over because he felt I was more adjustable to the needs of the job.
I'd like to take a closer look now at some of the problems. You went through the more or less summary of your work, which certainly does cover a tremendous number of topics. What main problem do you run into primarily? Probably a lot of things could answer that question, but what major problem seems to occupy the greatest amount of your time with the students now in the personal end of the business?
Well, I'd venture to say that as I see a pattern develop that can lead to nothing more than trouble for the boy or girl, the main problem is finding the time to get to the parents. I operate first by contacting the parents because they're the ones responsible for the child's attendance and conduct, of course. If it's definitely an attendance problem, I think so many parents working. Well, actually, let's put it this way, that there are various things I look for when these patterns start to develop, to see first if they're going to have receptive parents. It's very difficult when they're not receptive because some of them resent any outside interference in what they feel is their own personal privilege of raising a child as they see fit. But I kind of look for five things in a way when I see identify early identification of these problems. One, number one, is physical handicap, where a child just can't hold his own in the school population. Some develop a school phobia. Some have an attitudinal thing picked up from their parents, where their parents haven't established any values to education or schools in general, because they may have been deprived of the school, a good school experience. Broken homes, broken in various ways, as you well know, might be drinking parents, or doting parents, or divorced parents, or departed parents, delinquent parents, but broken in some way, and then deprived homes, whether that deprivation is material or psychological. Now, as we see those in the present time, you ask me what I feel is growing as the biggest concern, and I would say that this youth rebellion makes it more difficult because they have resisted authority in general. And to have a disciplined society, you have to have authority, and you have to have respect for that authority. If the authority in the home breaks down, that is transferred immediately over into school. And seeing that lack of credibility in the school then is makes it twice as difficult today. In three cases of truancy, I'm just recalling an instance now, I was outright lied to by, four cases of truancy, outright lied to by three of the four parents in their attempt to cover up for the child, or they didn't want to lose face, or they didn't want to cause trouble. That makes it extremely difficult. But as I started some time ago saying, the new permissive society, the kids, I believe, have too much money, too much free time, too little respect for earning what they get. In other words, just unearned affluence of some kind. And so they operate the same way in school. They expect a grade without earning it. But this might be off a subject, but I was thinking of one case now, an extremely bad case, some years ago, one of my early experiences in this job. I had an eighth grade boy, a little tough, that I would pit up against any high school senior. He was really tough in actions, looks, and physical being. He came from a very large family, 12 children, 11 of which ran afoul of the law in some way or respect. This boy, I met this boy in a bowling alley one night when I was bowling in the league. And I said, Tommy, I says, you ought to go home and study. You always told me that you couldn't do as well as the other kids because you were stupid. These other kids are home studying, and you're running around down a bowling alley. It's 10:30 right now. You're probably just as smart as they are, but you're just not doing the work. Sometime after that, something came up. This is the old junior high building. And I was called over to take this boy home immediately because one of the other cases he was involved with over there, when they contacted the home didn't believe the school story. They said their boy wouldn't do that and the teacher was at fault. So while it was ripe, the situation was ripe, they called me and I went over, took the boy down to the house, called the home, took the boy down to the house so I could tell them firsthand information exactly what he did face to face so that they couldn't refute the school story. I took him down to the house and the father was a foundry worker, a big, heavy-set, muscular, gruff, actually a wino. The mother was a frail little lady who was out doing housework. Large family, to say, but at that time, most of the family had gone. One older brother was shot during a burglary. But the father came staggering into the room when I was, while I was talking to the mother and explaining it to her, and he gruffly said, "I know you, you're the guy that helped me get my daughter out of school by giving her a work certificate." I said, "Oh yes, how do you do?" The mother says, "Get back in there, I told you to stay back in the other room while Mr. Phillips was here." "Ah, he knows me." So after the third pleading, he did go back, and I continued on, and the mother told the boy what he should have done and so forth, or should not have done. We walked out, I put him in the car, and we started back to school, and this little tough, about halfway back to school, broke out crying. I said, "Johnny," I said, "what's the matter?" I said, "I never thought I'd ever see you cry." And he said, "You remember when you saw me down to Bowling Alley and you told me if I'd stay home and study like those smart guys did, I could be as smart as they are?" And I said, "Oh, something to that effect." He said, "Would you stay in home like that?" That's just one illustration.
Yeah. Have you run into many situations like that?
Quite a few.
Good old Salem, USA.
You see, when you drive around past these houses and so forth, you don't know what's behind closed doors. And there are many like that. I remember one where at the morning they cooked a big batch, big bowl of oatmeal and sat it in the middle of a table. 8 children in a family. Whenever anyone got hungry, go over and take a spoonful of oatmeal. Sometimes no milk or anything else, just eat it dry. That family was ordered out of a condemned house. We were in court. The judge ordered them not to go back to the condemned house unless it was okayed by the school nurse and Mr. Phillips. And put quite a load on our shoulders because we weren't qualified to know what it was. But that's just one illustration. The same family, I remember, was given all kind of clothing. I'd made several trips down there. And we looked in the closet and there was all the clothing. Instead of washing the clothing, they just threw it over in the corner because they knew there'd be some more coming from some church group, schools or someplace. And there was probably 9 or 10 cubic yards of clothing packed over a stairwell there.
Are there really a lot of hard luck cases, let's call them hard luck cases, that you get involved with in what would be relatively a small town like Salem?
Well, I don't, that's the clue there, that in a small town like Salem, what is a lot? Here, I believe there are too many for the type of affluent district it is. But this money is used up now in the present day, now starting the economic situation right now is a little bit different. But there are many, many cases that no one knows, because of one very severe case, the boy came to school regularly and neat, but circumstances led to this home being entered by some authority. Police went in, they wouldn't allow them to see it, but they got some authority, the sanitation department or something, and it was ridiculous. They had a broken commode line. They kept on using it. They would throw their clothing over in a corner just like that until they had a closet full of clothing stacked through the ceiling. Pictures were taken of that, of course. And of course, the child was taken away from the home. But it took 3 or 4 months of work, investigation, and so forth before it was done. Too often, these things go on too long with a decided effect on the children before they're able to do anything about it.
Of course, you see it all the time, but then the teacher in the classroom at Riley or McKinley or junior high or anywhere else may suspect some kind of difficulty just in a glance at a student. But certainly, I know I have no idea. I have 180 kids a day. I'm sure that there are some hard luck situations there, and I'm just not aware of them.
I remember Mr. Kerr one time handing out a directive when I was still teaching of this burnt out family that I had trouble with after I was there. That's one of the deprived families I have to work with. Not have to work with, I work with. They were living in a cellar house with no furniture, nothing else. Everything was lost, very little furniture, and no electric or anything else, just gas, propane lamp of some kind. And he told them not to give them homework with the same degree as they'd give somebody else, because they certainly wouldn't have the same opportunity to do homework as other children would. Later on, as they got more furniture, the father was gainfully employed. They had a brand new carpet sweeper, I know, down there. But unfortunately, the incompetency of some of the people, while I was out the house one day, the little boy was sitting there hammering on this new, brand new vacuum cleaner with a teapot. And all I could see was about 15 dents at the top of it with nothing done. Just completely ignored the boy. He was playing, and that was it.
I wonder, so much talk about suspension of students. I know that finally they reach a point where this becomes a necessary situation. How have you seen that change over the year? I know it's tougher, but how far does a situation have to go before you suspend students, or in worse cases yet, have to go to the courts?
Actually, that's in the principal's jurisdiction, suspension, principal and superintendent. I don't suspend them unless I have a real, it's really tied in with something I've been referred by the principal to handle. Usually, if someone does something severe enough to be suspended, then the principal suspends him for 3 days, let's say, according to policy, after they've had a hearing and he knows exactly what he was supposed to do. But now, if that doesn't work and the boy or girl comes back and exhibits the same behavior as before, it's indicated that suspension didn't work, then they have to take some more severe means. That's when it gets referred to me. First, I go home, make a home call, talk to the parents, see if they can give any suggestion as to how we can keep this boy from going further into trouble. And I talk to the boy or girl, and then give them one more chance. For instance, some little things like making the family call in case he was going to be truant, make the family call in any time he's going to be absent so that the control lay on the family's shoulders. And so forth, so to remove the temptation, you know, of truancy or something. And any misbehavior, infraction of rules on a bus or anything like that, why, I warn them against that, because that would be just cause for reporting him to the juvenile official. Then if he continues on with this type of unacceptable behavior, whatever it may be, then I refer them to the juvenile officer as a screening agent, or a referee, you might call him. Then he, with the complete background of a child, in other words, I give him the home history, the social history, and so forth, and all the things he has done, so that the juvenile officer can talk to them intelligently. And he tries to see if he can put them on probation and avoid a court appearance. Now, if this fails, of course, it has to go on to the court. In other words, they're cited in, charged with being an unruly child. Sometimes they might find them neglected or unruly, incorrigible. Sometimes they might find the parent neglectful, too. But whatever it is, it finally goes to the judge. Now, he has disposition, as now they can send him to the honor farm, which you're familiar with. If they feel that the boy is beyond that and he needs detained in such a manner to let him compare his privileges he's losing, then he goes to the detention center or attention center, the accent's on the positive again. That's the Judge Louis Tobin's detention center, where he has to do his chores and through the merit system gets his free time. He can play ping pong or read books and so forth. He has to earn his privileges there. That's one way of learning it. If he does right, he's going to be rewarded. When he does wrong, he gets a consequence. And I think it's real well. Now, severe cases, of course, are sent on to the High Youth Commission by the juvenile court. Some cases, if they decide that the family is not a fit home, I mean, are not providing a fit home, then they hand them over to the welfare to find a foster home, which unfortunately now you cannot find foster homes for older kids. You can for the young ones, a few foster homes. But if they can find foster homes, they put them in there, then of course they go across, they're placed in the school district in which the foster home lay. That's
how many cases a year would you say you handle? Just a rough estimate. Is there any figure you could give me?
Any cases? If by cases, do you mean home visitations on a problem leading to referral?
Yeah, that's what I had in mind.
Well, I'm trying to recall now. In the last bi-monthly report, I recall, there were 68 home visitations. That would be 34, well, approximately 30 a month. I imagine it would average one and a half visitations a day, or well over 200 in a school year. Definitely home visitations where it's necessary to go in and talk to the parents over a problem.
A lot of these would be follow-up.
A lot of those would be follow-up. A lot of those would be severe, and probably I'm overlooking many cases where it's just to go in and talk to the family over some little matter, taking 5 minutes.
Mm-hmm. And maybe then I have to come back again, get it all resolved in just one conversation.
That's right. But severe cases, meaning family conferences, I think probably that's what I've had in mind when I was saying an average about one and a half a day. Now, sometimes I make a telephone call and have the parents come into the office and then detain at the closing time of the school. Then have the boy or girl stay there so that the parent can come in and we can talk it over while it's fresh in everyone's mind, problem cases. But when it's severe enough to make a referral to the juvenile officer, these are just attempts to avoid that, because that is time consuming and usually it builds up a resentment in the boy or girl, and we would like to avoid it if we can.
You mentioned using the phone. Do you have any idea of the number of phone calls?
Well, that's something too I remember from this last report. There was 612 phone calls, which many of them may have been overlooked, but those were outgoing phone calls. A lot of times it was calling someone maybe to, in certain situations, like I said before, that I asked many of these families to, in order to have better home control of the boy or girl who might be truancy prone, or to call in. But if I call out, I don't know how many the front office makes, but if I call out in situations, I imagine that would be 300 a month. I imagine it would average 300 a month contacts by phone.
Keeps you pretty busy.
A lot of these aren't definitely on truancy problems, behavioral problems, and so forth. Many of these are on transportation problems, whether it's a misconduct on the bus and so forth. The bus driver makes a report to me and so forth, then I have to make my investigation so I have all the facts on hand before we can charge somebody with property destruction on a bus, or maybe to ask them to deny them the privilege of riding. We have to have something concrete, evidence. And because it's difficult to have someone living 2 miles out in the country to walk in, especially a fifth or sixth grader. But I would say that's a good average, probably 300 phone calls a month. Pretty close.
You mentioned that the word truant, or term truant officer, passe, became a more positive reference to attendance officer, pupil accounting, pupil personnel, and that even the term detention center is now attention center to emphasize the positive. It seems like so many attempts to emphasize the positive, but yet you work with so many areas that are anything but positive. All the individual cases that you've mentioned in the general areas they fall into. Are there any bright areas in your work? It must seem awfully frustrating.
There are many bright areas. Every time you see results, in other words, you get positive results, it's a bright area.
Does that often happen very often?
I had a mother last spring after graduation make a trip out to the house and personally thank me for riding herd on her daughter. She was well known to me. I have known her for years, but I still, when I told her that she was doing very, lack of judgment in giving her daughter a new car when she was a junior, because right after she got the new car during her junior year, I caught her truant twice. The third instance, of course, we have to refer to juvenile authority disposition. And so I made her call in whenever the girl was going to be sick. And then I rode herd on her throughout her senior year. And I believe that that's the only reason that girl graduated, because she was prone to just running and enjoying life because she couldn't see too much in the future. She had plenty of money, very affluent family. But the mother was extremely gratified that someone took the time to interfere with her child raising, let's put it that way, because she knew that the girl benefited.
Positive interference.
That's right.
Certainly, at the beginning of this interview, all the areas you covered and the items that we've talked about so far leads me or anyone else to believe that you have a really difficult job and one that's quite demanding. The satisfactions you get out of it, usually, as you say, in the positive results that you can get. Do you have any final comments with regard to the job or your role in it, the feelings, attitudes that you have toward it, and your 25 years, let's say roughly 25 years at the helm of child accounting?
I believe that when I retire, I'm going to make a recommendation that the job be split, that they remove transportation from the job of child accounting, because it is so time consuming and takes so much more positive things can be accomplished, I think, if more time could be applied to just home visitations and so forth and contacts. But outside of that, I believe the key to the whole thing is someone who is willing to take the time to maintain this continuous accounting of all the students in the district and get away from the impersonalness of today. And that is that whenever you have a change in the physical structure of a school district, you're going to affect so many things like transportation and distribution of pupils and so forth. It's upsetting when you have a kindergartner lost on a bus run, which fortunately we never had completely lost. Sometimes three instances at the beginning of school because one bus teacher misread the bus that she was to put the children on, left three of them there because of the case of a bus picking the children up at one school, taking them up the other school, and then being transferred to a bus to take out in the country, because the other bus had too long a run in order to get down to this particular school, which was a parochial school. But I haven't formulated any philosophies or anything, but I believe if I were to make any suggestion, I believe it would be to separate the supervisor of transportation from supervisor of child accounting. Because in pupil personnel, it's a wide coverage and it's too much for one person to do his job to his satisfaction, what he feels is satisfaction, when he has so many demands from principals, bus drivers, superintendent, assistant superintendent, counselors, and so forth. Each one, in his estimation, is of prime importance. And you feel somewhat, let's say, frustrated, or I don't know the word offhand, that weak to get the job. You want to do that job, but you can't because you've got to set priorities. And that job must wait. Sometimes the force of working on the job loses its, you might say it loses its power when you let a job go for 3 days that should be handled the first day. That's the only final comment I could think of would be that I hope that someone in the future will maintain this continuous enumeration. You see, all changes in the school system have to come through my office. We have a form. And whenever a boy or girl moves away, transfers within the district, drops out of school, or whatever, that comes through on this change slip, and we note it right away in our central control cards, so that if it's necessary to revise a bus run, to set up a special class, to transport someone who moves into town, is placed in a special class, someone that's maybe referred to Bycroft, or referred to the psychologist, and so forth, that we can give those people who make the referral assistance as to the location of the boy or girl, what his needs are, and possibly some recommendation as to what some psychological needs are, too, based on the information and the past contacts I've had with the family, or the person who takes over this job.
Well, like so many other areas of education, and it, although it's tough to sell to the public and others involved in the school system, there's definitely need for more help so that the job can be done the way you and others feel it should be done.
Yes, I don't believe it's the only one either. I believe there's an awful lot of cases, but we have to do the best with what we have within the time and the money and the effort that's available.
Well, Mr. Phillips, before we finish up, I'd like to personally thank you. I thank everybody that I interview because I know my time's precious in the school system, and I know yours is too. Thank you very much.
Thank you.